Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Monday, February 8th, Alan and Joe spoke with investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies Jennifer Burns, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post.
Let us go to what is going to begin tomorrow, and that is the impeachment case, which aims to marshal outrage of the Capitol attacks against Trump. When House impeachment managers prosecute former President Donald Trump this week for inciting the Capitol attack, they plan to mount a fast-paced, cinematic case aimed at rekindling the outrage lawmakers experienced on January 6th. That rekindling is important because apparently some lawmakers have forgotten about it, even though it happened like 25 days ago. Armed with lessons from Mr. Trump's first impeachment trial, which even Democrats complained was repetitive and sometimes sanctimonious, the prosecutors managing his second are prepared to conclude in as little as a week, forego distracting witness fights, and rely heavily on video, according to six people working on the case. It would take 17 Republicans joining every Democrat to find Mr. Trump guilty, making conviction unlikely. But when the trial opens on Tuesday at the very scene of the invasion, the prosecutors will try to force senators who lived through the deadly rampage, as they met to formalize President Biden's election victory, to reckon with the totality of Mr. Trump's months-long drive to overturn the election and his failure to call off the assault. The story of the president's actions is both riveting and horrifying. This from Jamie Raskin, the Democrat congressman from Maryland and the lead prosecutor. He said this in an interview: "We think that every American should be aware of what happened, that the reason he was impeached by the House and the reason he should be convicted and disqualified from holding future federal office is to make sure that such an attack on our democracy and Constitution never happens again." So those are the hopes. Then there's the reality. Alan, go ahead.
Well, y'all, here's the way I'm seeing it. This is a hell of a mess, right? We all know that. We have a bunch of spineless, awful Republican senators whose patriotism dims when it comes to protecting themselves, protecting their colleagues, doing what they need to do. What they've done, but what they're going to do is they're going to vote for his acquittal. At least that's what we're being told. In the meantime, the American people are going to be seeing it one more time. And I think that is so important. I think that's what it's really all about here, that people will once again see the words coming out of the mouth of the president: "You've got to fight like hell," unquote. "And you've got to go to the march, and I'm going to march with you." It couldn't have been more explicit than that. And yet they're going to just simply say, fall back on the constitutional arguments: "You can't do it after the fact. After he leaves office," which is ridiculous. What if he did something on the last day of his presidency? You couldn't hold him responsible for that. So I think this is a terrible moment for the Republican Party, because they are in bed with Trump. They can't get out. They don't know what to do. And they're going to be held responsible, in my mind.
Jennifer Burns.
There's a lot of things that I've been trying to separate. And one of the first ones is looking at this impeachment and how embroiled it is in the last impeachment. Because Republican rebuff is really, you know, you just keep stalking Trump. You're just after Trump. And I think, you know, a part of me really says we have to, I know it's part of the record, his record, that he was impeached once before, but try to move people away from the first impeachment so that they can focus really on just this one. Because the punishment after, I know, is a very, you know, is the critical piece that he will never be able to run for office again. But in my mind, sometimes I say that's secondary. That's the additional consequence because of this crime you've committed now. You know, kind of a sorry for your luck, but maybe you should have thought about your past offenses that have created your record. So, you know, I've been trying to move friends that I'm talking to away from that first impeachment. I know it's so important and it's part of the story, but when we just consider what will be displayed here, it looks like they're going to be playing a video of this entire buildup with all of the tweets, the threats, even hang Mike Pence during this insurrection, the constant tweets for years of building momentum for this event here, and then the rally the day before. Here is the event we're talking about. And that hogwash about you can't try somebody after, I just treat as hogwash, because this is the day the crime happened. This is what led up to that crime. This is, or the alleged crime, I should say. So here it is. You don't get to say, well, it's 10 years later, so, you know, now I'm not in that job anymore. And, you know, now that date has passed, so don't try me for anything. We can't go with that. We have to kind of just pinpoint right now with when it happened. And this is the date of this event and the buildup that led to it. That's a naive take, I guess, but that's how I've been trying to focus on it, because then it becomes far more clear, especially if they're playing this video of the buildup with the tweets and the threats and the mob, and including the testimony or the criminal releases of the people who have been charged and what they're saying about how they were following Trump's direction.
Yeah, I don't think it's naive at all. I mean, it's certainly what we should be considering. Whether we will or not, it's obviously another story. Libby Post.
Well, I think the video, the use of video, the use of this visual that I'm telling you is going to be really well produced, which is half the battle. I'm sure there'll be music. I'm sure, you know, the emotional part of this will be laid out for everyone who's going to watch it. I think it will be very compelling and damning. And if the Republicans still, you know, won't vote to impeach, which I have a feeling we're not going to get 17 of them to suddenly see the light because they're just too afraid of their own shadows and Trump's specter. I think it'll still have quite an impact. And the idea that this man has been impeached twice and now we want to convict him, I don't think we'll get those 17 senators. But, you know, I am hoping that when this is over, they will still be able to, I think it's the 14th Amendment, be able to use that with a majority vote to make sure that he can never run for office again. For me, you know, he can have his Secret Service detail. He can have his $1 million a year, whatever, you know, expense account. He can have all those trappings. I just don't want this man to be able to run for office, whether it be dog catcher with no, of course, with no expense to dog catchers, or president of the United States. I mean, I really just want him never to be able to run for office in this country again. And I think that's the most important goal out of all of this.
Rosemary Armeo, your thoughts.
Well, I was one of the Democrats who thought the last impeachment was overbearing and redundant, and I would like to see a much better presentation this year. Yeah, once a year we impeach Donald Trump.
it's our rite of passage every spring.
Yeah, instead of all these senators getting up there and talking to hear themselves speak, especially Adam Schiff, maybe we could really prosecute this like a crime, because it most truly was a crime, the most clearly impeachable offense committed by a president ever in American history. And it needs to be presented that way, even if you can't sway enough senators, Republican senators, to make a difference. And maybe there's some hope being held out by historians looking at this, that doesn't have to be so. Maybe it won't be 17, but maybe we could get closer than just Democrats plus Susan Collins and Mitt Romney voting the right way. And that is because the constitutional argument is baloney. Rand Paul was absolutely wrong. And this came out this weekend, a big blow to conservatives when Charles Collins, now he's a Republican lawyer who should be, if things were more legit, he should be representing Trump. And he came out and said, it is baloney that you can't impeach after the fact. And there's some talk about Rand Paul coming up and reintroducing his measure to throw it out as unconstitutional, but to recraft it. And if that's happening, you're going to get a really interesting argument. If Jen is interested in the historical record being set here, I am interested in the legal record being set. I think the Republicans have broken impeachment. There is now really no defense for a president who does wrong, or for the people against a president who does wrong, if Donald Trump gets away with this. You can't impeach him before. You can't impeach him later. The Senate doesn't even have to have a trial. There's some shoring up needed in this process. I would love to see the Supreme Court take this up. I'd love to see Congress make some changes. So it goes beyond just Trump and the problems that he has caused, which we already know about. This is some real damage to the workings of the presidency in the United States.
Alan?
Well, I think everybody has made the point, but the essential point is that the Republicans aren't going to vote for it. That in the end, their offices, their stinking offices, are much more important to them and survival, political survival, than doing what is right. And I love what Rosemary just said because, you know, it's there for a reason. There is a procedure that we are supposed to follow, and it's supposed to be important to the survival of the American democracy. And these folks, and I really have nothing but contempt for them, are ignoring all of that.
Libby, when you think about where we are right now and what this next week is going to be, I was struck by what you were saying about, you know, this will be well produced and there'll be music and the whole thing. I mean, it is striking to me, and I don't think we should not talk about this, which is that the amnesia on the Republican side came very quickly as to this event, and forgetting that it was, you know, they were happened to be in the room when it happened.
Well, this is their modus operandi. I mean, come on. They all of a sudden they're talking about healing the country and working bipartisan, and Joe Biden's not being bipartisan, where for the last 4 years they've shoved everything down our throats without regard to bipartisanship. I mean, who are they kidding? You know, I mean, it's just absurd. So, yeah, amnesia is the order of the day for the Republicans, and it'll come back to bite them. I'm sure. I mean, the same thing happened here in the New York State Senate when the Democrats, you know, took over in 2019. You know, I remember the then Senate minority leader, who was the Republican, because they had lost control, you know, complaining about how the Senate Dems were treating them, that they weren't being fair. They're like crybabies, and so are the Republicans on the national level. They're just a bunch of immature brats who want their power back, and you know what? It's not going to happen for a while. So instead of being crybabies, is the best way to put it, do your job.
This is Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm producer Sarah LaDuke. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. For Tuesday's show, Alan and Joe were joined by immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, The Empire Report's J.P. Miller, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
Where were we? Oh, impeachment. So Trump is being impeached for the second time. The trial begins today. The lengthy legal brief provided by Donald Trump's team gives us the first extended look at the defense of the former president. So his lawyers laid out their impeachment defense on Monday, arguing that holding him responsible for the deadly January 6th Capitol attack was nothing more than, quote, political theater by Democrats, and the Senate had no power to sit in judgment of a former president. It was a 78-page brief submitted to the Senate on the eve of the trial. The lawyers asserted that Mr. Trump did not, quote, direct anyone to commit unlawful actions or deserve blame for the conduct of what they called a small group of criminals who stormed into the Capitol. They said the former president's rash of falsehoods about a stolen election delivered at a rally outside the White House before the pro-Trump mob mounted its assault were protected by the First Amendment. So, Alan, we now have not a big shock here, but we have an idea of what the Trump defense will be like.
I think we always knew, Joe, what it was going to be, and we always knew what the result was going to be. So we have a bunch of for want of a better word, feckless, spineless Republicans who, instead of defending the democracy, are going to undermine it. We know that, and we know what the result will be, and we know that the day after or the minute after he is acquitted, he will beat his chest and he will say, "You see, I won again." And that is really too bad that this jury, which put its hand on whatever Bible or whatever they do, or the Constitution, is not capable of listening and understanding that he did call for this. He set the meeting up with them in the beginning. He went back to the White House. He apparently sat back in his chair and chuckled and applauded what they were doing, and yet it's going to be framed as freedom of speech, and it's really terrible. It's a terrible thing for this country. Nevertheless, it's very important that this be done so that people will have a chance to see for themselves. Look, with all the lying and all the manipulation that this president was responsible for, he lost the election, and I think in the end, that's because people got the idea of what was going on.
So let's go to the lawyer among us and check in with Sienna on your thoughts, Sienna, about what will be taking place and the argument set forth by the Trump team.
Well, I'm not surprised by the arguments. When I reviewed the brief, I was looking at it, and I wasn't surprised that they relied heavily on the constitutional argument, which it would be the ideal strategy for, you know, what Republicans are choosing to hide behind. So that is the, to me, that would seem like the major portion of the brief was talking about that. The free speech argument is just, it just doesn't hit the legal standard. It's not a good argument for President Trump. So I think they're focusing on this constitutional argument to hide behind. I mean, when you think about free speech, you have to remember, I think this is important to point out, and I believe it wasn't in the response. I believe it was in the prior brief from the House impeachment managers. But, you know, incitement doesn't mean that this wasn't pre-planned, right? So incitement is a higher degree of encouragement, urging. So even if it was premeditated, if people came with intent to do this prior to him making the speech, incitement is encouragement. And so it's going to be hard for them to make that free speech argument, because I think he definitely meets the standard for incitement. I think that is an easy argument for them. That's a losing argument, I should say, for the defense in terms of free speech. That's why they're hammering and they are, you know, hardlining on this constitutional argument so the Republicans can vote on the constitutionality rather than on actually the merits of the case and the facts of the case.
The House impeachment managers filed a 5-page response asserting that each and every allegation in the article of impeachment is true, and that any affirmative defenses and legal defenses set forth in the answer, meaning the defense brief, are wholly without merit. Mike Spain.
My concern has been that they'll just make that case, as you say, Sienna, that it's unconstitutional to try a former president. And even though scores of attorneys agree with you that I've read, you know, that it's absolutely appropriate and it's set forth in the Constitution in the arguments we've gone over on this program many times, but they'll just stick to that. They'll even if they lose, which they will by the majority vote, that it constitutionality is not a factor here when the Senate votes on that issue. They'll still use that to hide their true view on whether Trump is culpable in this or whether he should be exonerated. And they won't make that. They'll say, since it was bogus because it was unconstitutional, I'm not going to even vote. I'm not going to even dignify it with my vote in this matter. And they'll try to escape it. But I think that's so cowardly. The Washington Post has a really good op-ed piece today by Adam Kinzinger. He's a Republican member of the House from Illinois who voted for impeachment. And he says it's necessary for Republicans to step up to preserve and save the Republican Party. And I think a lot of Republicans realize that. This is an existential point for the Republican Party. If they don't take care of the Trump issue now, it's just going to be there to haunt them and haunt them and haunt them.
JP, Senator Tammy Duckworth says the impeachment trial is a choice between our constitutional values and Donald Trump. I assume, obviously, that is going to be the House manager's argument throughout much of this trial.
Yeah, and I'm frankly surprised that the U.S. Senate is going to spend an entire week on this trial. I feel like we as a country have gotten past, we're past the Trump presidency. We're moving on, hopefully. And I'm surprised that it's not a 1 to 2 day trial for us to go back and relive, you know, what I thought was the worst day that our country's had in 20 years and relive all that. And not only relive it, but also they're going to have to give the Trump lawyers equal time. The Trump lawyers are going to show, you know, Democrat lawmakers allegedly inciting protesters when you know those protests ended up in burning buildings being burned this past summer. They're going to engage in their disinformation campaign to show their side of the argument. And for us to spend an entire week on this, I think is kind of crazy. And I also think that less and less Americans are going to be tuning in and watching this. It's a foregone conclusion. Everybody knows what's going to happen. Why don't they spend a little less time on it and a little more time on the Biden agenda?
JP, what do you make of Trump being so quiet, untypically quiet during all of this?
I am surprised by it. I've never known him to be quiet. He is, without the Twitter feed, that's a big platform that he does not have, that he generated a lot of chit-chat over the last 5 years, obviously. I think without that, he's hampered. I don't know. I guess news stations would want to do an interview with him, but who... I just don't know. I agree with you, Alan. It's wild that he's quiet. I also think it's a huge benefit to all of us in the country that he's quiet.
Yeah. Yep. No one complaining. Yes, of course, Sienna.
I was just going to say, I think the reason why he's so quiet, other than the fact that he doesn't have the platform of Twitter, is that all of those companies, the voting machine companies, are, you know, filing lawsuits right now. And I think it may become a liability if you bring Trump on your station and he starts speaking about the voter fraud again. He brings it up and he starts talking about it. And I think that's what you're seeing a lot in the media, is trying to avoid that liability by, you know, bringing him on and him talking about the voting machines and the voting fraud again. Because we're seeing a lot of lawsuits coming out. Fox News has one, I know. So yeah. It's just, I think companies are protecting themselves as well. So he may be having a problem getting his message out.
You know, you may really be onto something here. This guy is going to have a lot of legal problems now. And I'm quite sure that part of his silence is the idea that he just doesn't want to remind people of what a jackass he is. I think that's the last, and I don't want to give jackasses a bad name. That's probably why he's being quiet. Somebody told him to shut up.
Alan Chartok on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, February 9th. We'll be back with more Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuc. In addition to Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue, Wednesday's panelists were Rosemary Armeo, lecturer and adjunct professor in communications at SUNY New Paltz and RPI, Terry Gibson, and Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin.
Yesterday, of course, was the opening day of the Senate impeachment trial, and the weakness of Trump's case was on display. Representative Jamie Raskin, the Maryland Democrat leading the prosecution, opened with a video montage showing both the January 6th attack and Trump's words during that day. Raskin later delivered an impassioned argument recalling his own experiences. All around me, people were calling their wives and their husbands, their loved ones, to say goodbye, Raskin said. Senators, this cannot be our future. This cannot be the future of America. We cannot have presidents inciting and mobilizing mob violence against our government and our institutions because they refuse to accept the will of the people. Trump's lawyers condemned the attack on the Capitol, but said Democrats were pursuing impeachment out of partisan vengeance, and they argued that making a former president stand trial would establish the precedent for any other former official to be punished at the whim of the party in power. This is nothing less than the political weaponization of the impeachment process, David Schoen, one of the president's lawyers, said. But the performance of Trump's lawyers received mostly dreadful reviews, even from Trump himself, who was furious while watching the proceedings from Palm Beach, Florida. Several of Trump's Senate allies, including Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham, criticized his lawyer's case as ineffective. Bill Cassidy, a Louisiana Republican, called the prosecutor's case focused, organized, and compelling. President Trump team was disorganized. Cassidy added, they did everything they could but to talk about the question at hand, and when they talked about it, they kind of glided over it, almost as if they were embarrassed by the arguments. One congressman, Republican congressman, asked what his issue was with the Trump defense, and he said, did you listen to it? So, we begin there. Alan.
Well, first of all, you know, this was a terrible effort on the part of the Trump lawyers. And why? Because they don't have a case. I mean, you know, there is no case that they can make. They couldn't put on a video montage because what would they show? The Democrats did a terrific job. And, you know, all I got to say is I was blown away by what they were saying. I just thought that there was nowhere to go for the president, who, of course, is still trying to make an argument that he was deprived of the election. And that's why he apparently lost the first legal team he had hired, because they wouldn't do it. And these guys wouldn't do it either. So, of course, you know, you had the president criticizing them for their presentation, but their hands were also tied.
Well, and people now wondering just how long they'll last, if they'll last even through the trial. Rosemary.
Okay, so I feel a little sorry for them. They have a difficult case. They have a very difficult client. They had no time, and they're on a national stage. So I can see that they're nervous and disjointed. I don't get me wrong. I thoroughly enjoyed that the president, the ex-president, ended up being embarrassed. But it was kind of painful to watch them. And I would be completely sympathetic except for that poem. What was that poem? And he read the whole thing, 82 stanzas, tears in his eyes. I don't get it. And, yeah, they're in trouble. I would point out that he doesn't have a good case, but there are arguments that could be made in the president. We didn't, for the ex-president, we did not hear them yesterday. And the two lawyers said, well, you know, we didn't expect this. We thought we were going to just argue constitutionality of impeachment. So I'm looking forward to today to see if they can pull it together and make an argument. Maybe it's free speech, for example, and try to do something for Trump.
Bob Griffin.
You know, if you're listening and you're confused about what we're talking about, take the 13 minutes out of your day and watch the video that was presented yesterday as evidence. And if that doesn't both shake your confidence in D.C. and make you angry, then I don't know what does. I watched that video and I thought, if this isn't an impeachable offense, I don't know what is.
I thought the presentation by the Democrats was well thought out. I thought they presented a very cogent case. I thought that the poem was very strange, but then I kind of thought that maybe what they were trying to do was take a page out of Biden's swearing in ceremony, where the poem was so well received that, you know, that they thought, okay, well, we'll give that a try. It's impossible though, Joe, to watch that video and not realize that we have elected officials, even in our own area, who are supporting cop killers and traitors. I mean, there's no other way to defend our politicians who are so feckless that they will not do the right thing and hold Donald J. Trump responsible. And I'll make this as a final comment and pass it on to Terry. But, you know, if they aren't going to impeach him, then he should be arrested. If the argument is that, oh, you can't impeach him because he's out of office, then he should be arrested and he should be charged.
Terry.
Well, I certainly don't feel sorry for Trump's lawyers. They did, after all, sign up for this. Nobody's forcing
right.
them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it reminded me of students that come to my public speaking class and don't do their preparation, don't do their homework, don't do their research, and try to stand up in front of the class and fake it and hope that nobody notices. And you know what? We noticed. They were not prepared. I mean, how could they not have anticipated what the Democratic strategy was going to be? I mean, what did they think they were going to talk about? I thought the Democrats did a spectacular job of laying out a very concise argument, and it's exactly what I would think any decent lawyer would have anticipated that they would do. So the fact that they were caught off guard by that, to me, just goes to show you know, how just incapable these individuals are, and it is going to be interesting to see what they do moving forward. But I do think that video that they played, and as I understand it, they're going to be playing more videos and maybe even some footage that hasn't been seen yet, just very, very effective and gut-wrenching to have to relive that all over again.
How about the vote to actually go with the trial? I mean, it was mostly among partisan lines, but there were some Republicans that said, okay, I think we should go forward. I would assume, as dismal as the day was yesterday for the Trump defense, that no minds were changed here on the panel, that this the outcome is still a foregone conclusion, right, Al?
Not mine. You know, look, I think these people are in a terrible spot. They know these things are going to be made into ads. They know they're going to run them against them. Everybody in a Republican district is, and which is, by the way, why four Republicans have decided not to run. I think that's a big part of it. And by the way, I just can't help but say how much I loved what Terry said about the unprepared students standing up to give their speeches, because that's exactly what it felt like. I thought so. Extraordinarily correct. No, these guys have made up their minds. The only way to save themselves is to vote no on impeachment. And there's going to be tremendous amount of pressure on them.
And Joe, if I could, I think, Alan, I think you're spot on. I think the reason we're starting to see so many early declarations of senior GOP senators deciding not to run again is the fact that they realize that they're in an untenable position. I mean, but you look at that video and you start to think back to what used to be sort of core principles of the GOP, and you realize there's nothing left. You know, and the whole position is so bloody bankrupt that it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing watching, you know, even Cruz and Lindsey Graham sit there and contort themselves trying to figure a way to defend the undefendable. I'll also note that I thought the as I was watching the initial comments from Trump's attorneys, is that, boy, if this doesn't sum up this guy's career, I don't know what else does. I mean, the dumpster fire just continues.
Robert Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, February 10th. This is Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, February 11th, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue spoke with Edward Hamilton, Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI and Faculty Associate of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly, and counterterrorism expert and best-selling author, Malcolm Nance.
The House impeachment managers emphasized the danger to Mike Pence and other top officials in a harrowing retelling of the January 6th attack. They led a rapt U.S. Senate on a retelling of the terror that engulfed the Capitol, sharing shocking new audio and video recordings of rioters declaring their intent to harm Vice President Mike Pence and other top officials, and showing how close they came to doing so. The House Democrats, led by lead manager Jamie Raskin, spent day two of former President Donald Trump's impeachment trial displaying violent video scenes of the January 6th attack and the rioters' relentlessly raw language, including chants to hang Pence, and a sinister clip of a man looking for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi asking, Nancy, where are you, Nancy, in a very menacing way that I will not try to reenact. All of it, the impeachment manager said, was a direct result of the president's months-long effort to persuade his supporters of the big lie that the election had been stolen. After he had exhausted all other options to overturn President Biden's victory, they said, including dozens of lawsuits and a sustained campaign to pressure state election officials, Trump turned his sights to January 6th, the day Congress was scheduled to formalize Joe Biden's victory. Okay, so we now move on to day three today, and the House managers are expected to wrap up their opening arguments. So, Alan, where are we right now?
Well, first of all, I think that the managers have done a superb job, really superb, and putting it all together. You may notice that each of the people who have been speaking and speaking so well pick up a similar, folder, which obviously has what they're going to say in it. And they've done a great job. Now, I want to go to the Pence part of this thing. They talk about Pence, the managers. And the reason they're doing that is that the jury, we know who's on the jury. The Democrats are going to vote for impeachment for the most part, except for one. The Republicans are where the problem is. So if you keep saying Pence, and you show Pence fearing for his life and running with his family and moving out, then I think, there's a clear intent to say to the Republicans, hey, look, this isn't only a Democratic-Republican thing. This is your vice president, and look at what they're doing to him. And now I defer to my betters, who all know more about this than I do.
Let's start with Malcolm Nance. Malcolm.
Yes, I thought that the first day of the managers bringing up all of the materials that led up to this showed a direct line between Donald Trump and the violence on the Hill. Now, this is common sense for all of us, but I want to call attention that all day yesterday, Fox News played not 1 minute of this. They didn't address this at all until it came on Tucker Carlson's show at like 7 or 8 o'clock at night. So, there is actually this sort of bipolar media world right now where the true damage, the true emergency that happened during that attack is still only being seen by two-thirds of the country. One-third, and again, I monitor their chats in the early morning hours. I get up at 3 a.m. to monitor their chats and Telegram channels. Virtually none of them saw any of that video. And on the right wing. And their leadership there, they don't care. This is all about circle the wagons on Donald Trump. I have to tell you, I was chilled at some of the stuff that I heard there, especially the police radio calls of how desperate and dire an emergency it was for the Metropolitan Police Department, who were actually running the front line around the building. I've got a new book on right wing extremism and what I think is a coming Trump insurgency. In the interviews with the police officer Mike Fanone, these people were screaming in his face, "Kill him with his own gun! Kill him with his own gun!" it was a terrifying incident. And now the Republicans have circled the wagons, and they said you can't impeach Trump when he's president. You can't impeach Trump when he's a civilian. And I would like to hear Alan's thoughts on this. They actually Terrible. Made a pretty strong case that Trump should be tried criminally as a civilian.
I thought so. I thought that's exactly right. Malcolm, could we go back to your remarks for a moment there? And sure. Let me ask you, the coming insurgency that you just mentioned, could you tell us a little bit more about what you're seeing in the crystal ball?
Yeah, and, you know, if anybody saw we talked about this during a good piece of the summer, where I said this stuff was building up right here on this program. And when I went on Bill Maher's show on November 6th, 3 days after the election, you know, everybody on the show was all kumbaya, let's pull together. And I warned, I said, you know, I'm not seeing this. I'm going to give you doom and gloom. We have an insurgency coming. And when I say insurgency comes in three different phases. And this is a phase one insurgency, which is a rejectionist movement which views the current government as illegitimate, and they start with a political rejectionist front, and they have paramilitary and terrorist forces that will discredit this government so that it appears that no one can be made to feel safe except for this quote-unquote president in exile that Donald Trump is. And in fact, the insurrection on January 6th is likely going to be the first. You know, right now they're building up amongst themselves and in their little Fox News and QAnon bubble that, you know, that we are now occupied by communists. And you know, Joe Biden is inviting hundreds of thousands of Chinese soldiers into the United States. It's nuts, but it's nuts with guns. And they are really starting to think that they're living some fantasy of being in the first throes of, of defending Lexington and Concord. It's really like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, the way that they think that they live in this reality as the only true Muslims in Islam. These guys in Trump's army are technically viewing themselves as the only true patriots. And it's like that little joke that's been going around about, you know, how one of these Donald Trump QAnon followers dies and goes to heaven. And when he gets to St. Peter's gates, he says to St. Peter, St. Peter says to him, why are you here? And he said, because I defended Donald Trump. I defended America and died in it. And St. Peter says, well, the election wasn't stolen and QAnon is fake. And the guy who died says, my God, the conspiracy goes even higher than I thought. That's what we're dealing with.
Yeah. All right. Now that you have appropriately scared the zippers off of us, Vera.
So I wanted to also mention one of the issues that really affected me when I was watching these videos. I agree that, you know, about the strategy and how effective it was, at least for those of us who already know there's a relationship between, you know, what Trump said and what the group or these mobs of terrorists did, right? We right. understand that. We believe in the incitement, but I also at the same time, it is clear already that a fair number of the senators do not see that linkage. They are going to vote along the lines of, well, yes, that was criminal conduct, but Trump has nothing to do with it. So we know that is likely the outcome. But personally, I have to say, watching these videos and receiving the additional information, hearing the sounds, the whole audio reminded me of incidents in Latin America, in the Middle East, when I watched these absolutely these angered mobs gathering in their mercilessness, in sort of this rabid foaming at the mouth behavior that is reinforced in these crowds. And to see what Capitol Police had to face, looking out and seeing thousands of these people, pushing towards them, beating them, calling on them to be, you know, attacked, subdued. It reminded me so much of some of those incidents that many of us who travel internationally or work internationally in areas where we have insurgencies and deeply angered groups of populations rising up, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my gosh, this reminds me so much of those sort of observations and sentiments where you know it doesn't matter what you have done or what you not have not done. If the crowd comes for you, there's absolutely no control of emotions, no control of this kind of violence and this level of anger. And that is exactly what we saw. And
well,
extremely dangerous.
Well, you mentioned all those other countries, but of course, your home country, Germany, wrote the playbook on how this is done, yes?
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is in my personal lifetime, I've experienced those kinds of things, right? When you talk about my grandparents, of course, you know, that in essence, when you look at the pogroms, Kristallnacht, those types of events, the same sort of mobs coming for people, targeting a particular subgroup, an ethnic group, a religious group. I mean, all these comments you make and the comments Malcolm made are all fitting together. It's all a puzzle of how these kinds of dynamics emerge and how dangerous it is. And to see that happen at the Capitol is shocking to the core each time. Each time, I think, it reinforces what a dangerous situation we're in.
Fran Berman.
Yeah, I had two reactions to this. And, first of all, I think that the arguments were exquisitely done. And, you know, it makes you think, well, if this isn't impeachable stuff, what is? Mm-hmm. They did a fabulous job of creating a story around really tragic and incredibly harrowing activities. But really what made me, it also made me think about sort of the broader comment on culture, that we are in such an amalgam of separate realities due to all of this polarization, that there's so little empathy from one side to the other, and that the difference between the lived experience and the observed experience, I think for the people in Congress that day and for many of us, it was just so present. On the other hand, for lots of other people, it was like TV. It was like fantasy. It was like maybe it didn't exist. And that kind of thing scares me because we see that all the time. And I think that makes things very, very difficult in terms of ever trying to get any kind of cohesiveness and any kind of community that's really going to help us get out of this craziness.
Fran Berman on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, February 11th. This is Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, and we'll be back with a bit from Friday's show after this. Welcome back to Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Friday, Alan Shartok and Joe Donahue were joined by former EPA Regional Administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Siena College professor of economics, Aaron Pasitti, and Albany County District Attorney, David Soares.
Well, we'll talk impeachment. As Alan indicated, we're finally going to get to the House managers wrapped up their argument yesterday. And so now it's Donald Trump's turn. His defense will go before the managers to say what's on their mind. But the impeachment managers rested their case, imploring the Senate to convict to prevent future violence. That was a case that was made several times throughout the proceedings yesterday. Wrapping up against it, imploring the Senate to convict him because they say, we humbly ask you to convict President Trump for the crime for which he is overwhelmingly guilty of, because if you don't, if we pretend this didn't happen, or worse, if we let it go unanswered, who's to say it won't happen again? Now, Trump's legal team is poised to respond on Friday, arguing that he should be acquitted. They are expected to use only one of two allotted days. A verdict could come as early as the weekend. All right, Alan, let's start. This is taking less time than any of us expected, I think. There were some early projections that this could go into next week. It won't. So, or by all likelihood, it won't. So where do you think we are right now?
Well, we know where we are, and that is that some of the obsequious, cowardly, lack of backbone, spineless Republicans who are sworn jurors are not following their oaths. We also know that some of it is coming apart. We know that because Nikki Haley, of all people, is being reported by CNN to have said, basically, she's not following this president anymore, who has deceived the American people. And, quote, he's fallen so far. That's extraordinary. And, if she's going, and she is often mentioned as a potential Republican presidential candidate, she's putting her finger up in the air and seeing which way the wind is blowing. And the miscreants on the other side who have sworn allegiance to Trump must be noticing that because, once people start to jump off the sinking ship, there are an awful lot of bodies in the water. I'm thinking that, it's probably not going to happen. But the Democrats have done a superb job. I've been criticized for saying the Democrats, let's put it this way, the House managers, who happen to be Democrats, have done a superb job of putting all of this together. And I don't think there's any other way out of it. This is nothing but a disaster for the Republican Party.
You bring up such a great point. David, let me ask you, as district attorney, in my mind, agreeing with Alan, you can't think that the House managers could have possibly put together a better case than they did. They put it together, and yet they still probably, as of this moment, will not prevail.
I want your audience to understand that although a lot of what's being discussed and presented is being discussed and presented in the context of a trial, this is nothing like your a traditional trial. In other words, prosecutors don't present cases to a jury that consists of victims, witnesses, and unindicted co-conspirators. And that's the challenge that the prosecutors in this instance bear, right? I will say this. Jamie Raskin and the team that has been put together around him, they have done an incredible job. Let me just say that it's about as close to perfect as you can find, because what they've done is they've personalized this experience so much. And as I said, the jury here consists of victims, witnesses, and unindicted co-conspirators. And subtly, they've managed to project this case in a way that speaks to them in the context of who they are in those three categories. Hence the reason why Hawley and others have left the environment, are sitting in different places, pretending not to pay attention. They're the unindicted co-conspirators in all of this. And for some of our jurors, we've seen the re-traumatization of these folks as they've gone over the last 4 days. And so it has been an incredible thing to witness. They've done a fantastic job. Their mixture of videotape, audio, dispatch recordings, it's forced every viewer to go right back, almost in a time machine, like to relive that experience. And it certainly put those Republican jurists who will have to vote, it has put them in a very difficult place. The only objective today for Trump's defense team, and this sounds odd, they're not having the burden of going out there to convince anybody of anything. The only thing that they have to do is present a small lifeline to those people that don't want to vote against President Trump. And if they can just dangle that lifeline out there a little bit today, you'll find the Rubios and all of those folks who want to appear as though they're pro-law enforcement, you will find that they will jump on that. It's not constitutionally sound for us to do this lifeline that the defense in their hopes will float to them today.
Judah, think.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the House managers were speaking to the public, the American public, more than, you know, Lindsey Graham or Ted Cruz or Hawley. Because if you convince the public, then you see the conversions of the Nikki Haley's of the world, because they see that there's no public support for armed insurrection in our state capitol. Imagine that, federal capitol. So what they were doing was establishing the public record, and I think they did it incredibly effectively. I think even if there is not a conviction, Trump is politically wounded. If he was thinking of not only running again, but when he makes threats against people who are not loyal to him, I don't think it's going to have the political potency that it would have had a few months ago. And I just want to say how incredible Representative Jamie Raskin was. We all know his personal story. I mean, to lose a son and then to the next day be leading the presentation in the House. I mean, I don't know how this guy keeps going, but what a patriot Jamie Raskin is. And then my final borderline ridiculous point is, I think that if these proceedings were on Zoom today with the two Trump attorneys rather than in person, is there any question that the Trump attorney would open his Zoom presentation with, "Your Honor, I am not a cat. I am a real person."
Can I ask you a question, Judith, because it's been bothering me a lot, and it's not going to be a popular thing for me to say. But I'm concerned about this idea that many Democrats are saying, yes, it's very important he not be allowed to run again and bring this chaos back to us a second time, because it would be, and he would mm-hmm. be doing all of those things. I'm very concerned because I think there are a lot of people in middle America who don't get that, who think that if somebody wants to run for office, they should be allowed to. Now, as you know, I'm behind no one, and I mean no one, when it comes to the condemnation of Trump's behavior. But I also have a tremendous sense that the American people know what's going on here. And I think this continual call for not letting him run again is a mistake. It's a mistake because of middle America, not because of the blue Democrats, but because there are many people who will say, well, that's just not right.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I think you're right about that, but it is the law of the land. If you are impeached, you then can have a majority vote not allowing the person to run. That some people may not want to get into the intricacies of that, but in terms of what's best for the country, of course, on one hand, everyone should have the right to run. But what Trump did was just so beyond the pale. I think people that want Trump to have the right to run are people that are not going to be concerned about the violence, the death, the damage that was done on January 6th anyway.
Judith Ink on the Roundtable panel on Friday, February 12th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke.
Where were we? Oh, impeachment.